This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
I'm here at MIT with Dan Evans, who is an astrophysicist here. Dan, welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
No problem. Just tell us a little bit first about your research here at MIT. MIT is very important with Chandra.
That's right. Chandra is controlled by Harvard and by MIT on behalf of NASA. It's actually a huge grant that NASA gave to the two institutions to run it. Chandra was launched back in July 1999, so it's almost at its 11th year now. And Chandra's main job is to take wonderful images of the sky in X-ray light. The special thing about Chandra is that it takes incredibly sharp images. And from that we can actually figure out a wide range of astrophysics, ranging from stars, sometimes even to planets, to galaxies, to black holes, to even the largest structures in the universe, namely galaxy clusters.
Mm. And your particular field of expertise is within the X-ray and multi-wavelength observations related to black holes.
That's right, yeah. So I primarily concentrate on Chandra observations of these guys, but I often use complementary observations from the Hubble Space Telescope and also the VLA, the Very Large Array, of radio telescopes down in New Mexico as well.
So looking particularly at supermassive black holes in active galactic nuclei, why are you studying that? Give us a reason why.
Well, let me give you a quick recap as to what an AGN, or an active galactic nucleus, is. This is the class of galaxies with supermassive black holes that are actively accreting or actively eating a huge amount of material. So it's kind of like this. You can imagine a black hole is kind of like a bath plug, for want of a better description. A material flows down towards this black hole bath plug and sort of slowly spirals around it. And as it gets closer and closer to the black hole, it actually spins faster and faster. Now, in order for that material to actually fall into the black hole, it's actually got to, as we say, lose angular momentum. It does that through frictional forces. Now, these frictional forces, effectively rubbing, generate heat. Heat generates light. And that light is actually given off primarily in X-rays. So by making photographs of the night sky in X-rays, we can actually figure out where the black holes are and what they're doing, and how they're eating. Okay, so my particular interest is to actually figure out exactly how much material accretes down onto the black hole, and in turn what happens to that material as it does so. So around 10% of AGN, of active galaxies, actually host what we call jets. Now, these are extraordinarily collimated beams of plasma that are shot out from close to the vicinity of the black hole. And they actually race outwards to extraordinary distances, something like 2 to 3 million light years away from that black hole. Now, jets actually act, for want of a better description, as energy carrying channels. They transport these vast sums of energy up to these huge distances. And in doing so, they can actually regulate the largest structures in the universe, which are namely galaxy clusters. So my interest is to actually understand how the accreting material actually falls onto the black hole, and how exactly these jets are produced, and in turn what those implications are.
So what's our current thinking on how these jets are produced?
Very good question. Wish I knew. No. So there are two main mechanisms, but both were put forward by a Brit by the name of Roger Blanford, who's a professor out in Stanford, I believe. Blanford and one of his collaborators, Payne, actually came up with the idea that jets can actually be launched from the edges of accretion disks. All we need to know is that intense magnetic fields and very wound up and collimated magnetic fields are needed to drive these jets off. So Blanford and his colleague Payne actually put forward the idea that jets are actually launched from the very edge of the accretion disk, very close into the black hole. And that's one idea for jet production. The other one is the so-called Blanford-Znaik effect, in which the actual rotational energy of the black hole, the spin of the black hole, is tapped. And you can imagine the magnetic field lines that I'm waving my fingers here can actually can wind up into a helical pattern, and it's from along that helix that magnetic fields can propagate, and indeed that's how plasma can flow along them and form a jet. Two kind of hand-wavy descriptions, but both are equally viable, and it's one of my goals is to actually understand exactly which one can produce these powerful jets.
Now, these jets are going at an incredible speed.
Okay. That's right. Yeah, they race out to pretty much close to the speed of light, actually, although that is somewhat dependent on the environment through which a jet propagates. So you can imagine that you have a somewhat more dense environment, and the jet will actually sometimes slow down, become transonic with respect to that gas, and then become somewhat turbulent as well, and then kind of flare out and puff out into a big fuzzball.
And the way that these jets propagate can actually affect the evolution of the galaxy itself.
Not only that, it can actually affect the largest gravitationally bound structures, which are galaxy clusters. So it's a pretty well-established fact that a certain portion of jets actually live in these giant X-ray baths. And these baths are incredibly hot balls of gas that typically have extent of several million light years again. The temperatures are a couple million degrees, and so they emit X-rays. And so the jets actually effectively blow bubbles in this gas, and in doing so, they actually regulate the subsequent evolution of that galaxy cluster. In other words, galaxy clusters wouldn't look like galaxy clusters without jets at the heart. So this tiny pinprick of a black hole turns out to affect the larger structures in the universe. That's pretty important.
That's very important, yes. So if we can just take it back to this small pinprick of the black hole. You mentioned earlier about black holes spinning. And it's my understanding that not all black holes spin.
Hotly debated
issue.
Okay. So I'm going to speak for the moment about supermassive black holes, which is where I do my research. This is an incredibly, incredibly contentious issue, at least in the X-ray community. We know that black holes can actually or should actually be spinning, and simulations show that black holes that may have actually really started spinning up at redshift of 6 or something like that could actually have a pretty appreciable spin today. Measuring that black hole spin, on the other hand, is darn difficult. So we actually primarily use Chandra observations and observations with other X-ray instruments to figure out exactly how black holes are spinning. The way we do that is to exploit a particular line, which we call the iron K-alpha line. So in a regular sort of picture, then you have an accretion disk, it's orbiting the black hole, and the iron K-alpha line is given off, and you can imagine that the portion of the accretion disk that's coming towards you is going to be blue shifted. That means it's going to be a displacement to the blue side, whereas the portion that's receding from you is going to be red shifted. So that's just like the Doppler effect. So this gives rise to what we call a double horned profile. Now, unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. Then relativity comes into play. Then relativity can actually alter the exact physical shape of this line, and it becomes distorted and skewed and kind of twisted up. So the goal really is to measure this distortion in this line. It produces a very noticeable distortion, but you have to have incredibly sensitive observations in order to be able to get that distortion and also to disentangle it from other effects that could be mimicking it. So very hot topic, very contentious topic, but if we can solve it, we can actually understand how the black hole can actually spin up throughout the history of the universe, and that's incredibly important for cosmology.
So, how does black hole spin originate?
Okay, that's a great question. The current leading theories actually predict that galaxy mergers are responsible for this. So, in earlier stages of the universe, you can actually get galaxies flying into one another, and then eventually the black holes will coalesce together, and in doing so release gravitational radiation. And so, sustained galaxy mergers over the history of the universe can actually spin up a black hole. That's the first way. And then subsequently, you need accretion of material in order to change that spin as a black hole grows older. So accretion can actually proceed in one of two ways. It can be called sustained and ordered, in which the idea is that you have a definite motion to how the accreting material falls onto the black hole, and that can pretty easily spin up a black hole. The other idea is that the accretion is so-called chaotic, and that means you can kind of imagine water droplets flying towards that black hole from all sorts of directions. And that really doesn't have a huge effect on the spin of the black hole, because of course everything's coming into the black hole from every single direction, so it's not going to alter the spin rapidly. So by piecing together these measurements from the X-ray, we can actually begin to understand which one of these models was correct and how accretion over the history of the universe proceeds.
So just returning to the jets, is that the only method of... Sorry. Are they basically the be-all and end-all? or is there another method of energy transference?
Transference is a good word, I like that. So, no, jets aren't actually the be-all and end-all. What we actually know to be pretty commonplace are wind. Now, winds, unlike jets, are a heck of a lot slower. Winds typically have velocities of around 2, 3, maybe 500 kilometers per second. Now, we believe winds are actually very commonplace in most AGN, in most active galaxies, whereas jets probably occur maybe only around 10% of the time, something like that. So the winds actually turn out have a very important role in how galaxies, individual galaxies, will evolve. So something that's really been impressed upon me over the past year or so is what we call the galaxy color magnitude diagram in astrophysics. And this basically says that galaxies fall into two rather distinct groups. The first one is the so-called blue cloud. Now here the galaxies are actually blue in terms of their colors, and they're actively accreting, actively eating material. And in those sources, we believe there's rapid black hole growth and rapid star formation to accompany that. Now on the completely different side, there are galaxies that form the so-called red sequence. Now, these galaxies are actually much more massive than their blue counterparts. We call them red or dead ellipticals. So that means that the black holes are larger, the stellar populations are more massive. But on the other hand, the black holes are kind of wimpy in terms of how much material they accrete. They don't eat very much, they don't do very much. Now really the name of the game in terms of galaxy evolution is to understand how these galaxies undergo the transition from blue to red and how their black holes grow in doing so. And one of the leading explanations that we invoke in astrophysics is to involve outflows. So these outflows could actually be responsible for gently quenching star formation. So that will allow a black hole to grow less quickly, but also allow stars to form less rapidly. So you can see immediately that if we have this idea of AGN outflows, the black holes and the stellar populations of the galaxies are actually going to kind of evolve in lockstep. And this goes towards the sort of holy grail of galaxy evolution, which is to understand exactly why there's such a strong correlation between the mass of a black hole and the mass of the stars within a galaxy. And outflows really are the leading explanation. So one of the main ways that we can actually search for outflows is to perform observations with Chandra and with the Hubble Space Telescope to figure out exactly what the spatial extent of these outflows is, to figure out how much energy these outflows are carrying outwards, and in turn to figure out how much mass the outflows are transporting. So if we can do that, we can actually provide some pretty strong constraints for our cosmology friends to go back and input into their simulations of galaxy growth.
You say that the size of the black hole is correlated to the size of the stars. Is it a simple size as one gets bigger, so does the other?
Yes, exactly that. It's a remarkable correlation. It was only discovered, I believe, back in 1999. And really it's defined this past decade in terms of galaxy evolution theories. And we're all searching for exactly why this should take place. And really outflows are by far and away the prime explanation for it. We just need to find out exactly how commonplace they are and exactly how much material they transport outwards.
Okay, so you said that only 10% of supermassive black holes accrete rapidly.
Yes.
Only 10% of those have jets. So we're talking only 1% of galaxies which are accreting rapidly and have jets. And yet this is being hotly studied. I don't want you to explain why you're studying this, but why are you studying this?
Well, thank you very much for diminishing my research. No, not at all. 2 points to come back to you on that one. The first one is that it could very well be the case that all supermassive black holes have undergone a period of activity, and in turn that all of those have actually shed jets or produced jets over the course of their lifetimes. So we need to understand both the galaxies that currently are active and those who aren't to actually understand how the galaxies can evolve, what that implies for a cosmological context. The second point to come back to you on is the energetic output of these things. Jets are amongst the most powerful objects in the universe. The energy that's given off by a typical jet might be something like 10 to the 51 watts. Obviously we need to understand how these gargantuan sums of energy are given off, and as I've said before, we need to understand exactly what the impact of these vast sums of energy is on the environments into which they propagate. So yeah, only 1% of galaxies may host jets, but that's a very important 1%.
And you're here at MIT at the moment. You've got Chandra, MIT Harvard, with Chandra. What is the present? What is the future for X-ray astronomy?
So the present is actually pretty good. We have a number of X-ray observatories. Chandra isn't the only one, although it's probably the best suited to studying these objects. We have XMM Newton, which is a ESA-led mission with substantial participation from the UK, actually, and mainly in terms of Leicester, Birmingham, Bristol, Cambridge have large X-ray groups. XMM's job is to collect enormous numbers of photons, whereas Chandra has a more limited photon collecting ability. It has much sharper resolution. So the two are very much complementary. We also have Suzaku, which is a Japanese-led mission with substantial participation from NASA. Now, Suzaku's job is to not only constrain what we call the soft X-rays, these are the less energetic X-rays that we see, but also to constrain what the properties of hard X-rays, i.e. more powerful X-rays, are. So with these two things working in tandem, we can actually determine a huge amount about the physics of the innermost portions of the accretion flow that surround a black hole. There are other X-ray missions. We have RXTE, which is the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer, which is led out of MIT and also at UC San Diego. And XTE's job is to perform very detailed timing observations and look for very short oscillations in the light that's given out from the accretion disk. So XTE's job is to look for flickering. So we have all these wonderful X-ray capabilities. But, and there's a but, with all these things in astronomy, there's a funding issue. And it turns out that X-ray astronomy is actually facing a bit of a lack of missions over these next 10 years. As we all work towards the holy grail, really, which is the IXO. This is the International X-ray Observatory. So IXO really is a tri-state approach to X-ray astronomy. It combines the efforts of NASA, of ESA, and the Japanese community as well, JAXA. And IXO really is going to supersede the capabilities we have today. It's essentially going to act as a massive light-collecting bucket. And from that, we can determine with great precision exactly how black holes spin by measuring the Ink alpha line, determine exactly how outflows proceed, and we can measure these and watch these evolve with time. And we can even watch things orbit around the supermassive black hole and decay as they fall in towards that black hole. So that's what it does in terms of black hole physics, but it also does extraordinary things for supernovae, for understanding what the content of the intergalactic medium is, for understanding even planetary astronomy. It's going to be very important as well. So IXO really is the holy grail of our community, but it's an incredibly expensive mission, something like $3 billion, and we need a huge amount of support to get it done. So I'm crossing my fingers.
And when is the possible launch date?
I think the current projection is something like 2021, but that's highly dependent on funding as well. There's a big review in the US called the Decadal Survey right now. ESA is undergoing a pretty similar process called Cosmic Visions, and the outcomes of those two reports are going to be later this year, and so that's really going to give us a strong clue as to where the field is headed.
Exciting times ahead for X-ray astronomy, let's hope.
I think so.
All the very best with your research.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.